Our second speaker is also, I am happy to say, no stranger to Philadelphia Society meetings in recent years. Gleaves Whitney is currently the chief speechwriter for Governor John Engler of Michigan, for whom he has worked since 1992. In 1993, he served on the governor's task force on education, whose work led to the enactment of reforms that even the New York Times called the most dramatic in the nation. When not immersed in his public responsibilities, Gleaves pursues a number of academic interests. He has been a Weaver Fellow and an Earhart Fellow while doing postgraduate work at the University of Michigan. Since 1995, he has been the Senior Fellow at the Russell Kirk Center for Cultural Renewal in Mecosta, Michigan, and since 1998, has been a Senior Scholar at the Center for the American Idea in Houston, Texas. He is also completing a doctoral dissertation on several 20th century Christian humanists, including Christopher Dawson. And it is his expertise on Dawson that now brings him to our microphone. Please.
Thank you very much, George. Well, first, I want to thank the president of the Philadelphia Society, John Wilson, and I want to thank Secretary Bill Campbell for the invitation to address you this weekend and on such a stimulating topic. My charge, and it is a pleasant one, George indicated this, is to not just to make you worry, but to introduce Christopher Dawson into our discussions this weekend, although after you hear about a little bit more about Dawson, you might be worried too. Dawson was arguably the greatest Roman Catholic historian of the 20th century. He was born in Britain 110 years ago this Columbus Day, and during a career that spanned World War I, the hyperinflation of the 20s, Great Depression in the 30s, World War II, and Cold War, he became a keen observer of the modern crisis and the many manifestations of cultural disorder that attended that modern crisis. Dawson decided on his mission in life very early, when he was just 19 years old. It was on Easter Sunday, 1909, on a trip to Rome. He was not yet a Roman Catholic when this happened. It was an epiphany that he had that was strikingly similar to that of Gibbon. He was ascending the Capitoline Hill in Rome, making his way up to the Ara Coeli Church, and he paused near the very spot where Gibbon had had his epiphany to write the decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Well, almost at that same spot, Dawson conceives his life project to undertake a comprehensive history of culture. And it was to be based on Lord Acton's dictum that religion is the key to history. Religion is the key to history. Well, Dawson spent the next 5 decades trying to write that book, and it came out in the form not of a magnum opus, but of scores of essays that were periodically collected in small volumes. Remarkably, a handful of his books are still in print some 3 decades after his death, and one of Russell Kirk's last projects before his passing in 1994 was to undertake a uniform edition of Christopher Dawson's work. It would have been in some 20 volumes. Now, also last night, Alan Kors told us about multiculturalism and the political correctness. We heard some very interesting observations about political correctness. But if you look at Dawson's life, you see that Dawson was also a victim of political correctness in his own day. This brilliant historian had the culture police denying him tenure-track positions, for example, in British universities. You see, it was always counted against him that he was a Roman Catholic convert, and he made his Roman Catholicism clear in his writings. It informed all of his work, not as a proselytizer, to be sure. He was a scholar, but you knew the assumptions that lay behind his work, and Dawson paid the price professionally because of this. Of all places, and I find this extremely ironic given the discussion we had last night, of all places, it was Harvard that finally offered Dawson a chair and a chair of Roman Catholic Studies in 1958. And then when Dawson comes over to the United States, what keeps him from assuming that chair initially is not the thought police of the 1950s, but his own health. At that point, he had chronic poor health. He was age 68. And the U.S. authorities, in fact, thought he had tuberculosis. It was only the intervention of a young Massachusetts senator, another irony here, a young Massachusetts senator that said, let's cut the paper chase here. This man is not going to give Americans and Harvard students tuberculosis. Let's let him assume his chair. I think you know the name of that senator. It's John F. Kennedy. John Wilson and I had a lively discussion the other evening trying to decide whether it was Kennedy's best thing he ever did in public life to admit Christopher Dawson, or the only good thing he did in his public life. Christopher Dawson would have been the first to admit that he was an historian, not a prophet. Nevertheless, he wrote a good many essays on our topic this weekend. Several of them are collected by one of our own, Gerald Rosello, into this book that was recently published, and I refer you to this book. Is Gerald in the room today? There he is in the back row. We ask whether Western civilization can survive the 21st century. Dawson spent his career, some five decades, grappling with whether the West would survive even the 20th. His best insights may be out of fashion, but they are not dated. Several of his chief ones I would like to summarize, eight in all, in hopes that they will cast light on our discussions this weekend. First point, and this is the most basic, and we already heard it introduced by Eric Boglin and Ellis Sandoz. Dawson insists that we understand the relationship between religion and culture. Religion, he argues, is what puts the cult in culture. That's a very interesting word. It's a Latin word, cultus, and it means cultivation and also worship. And this is very revealing to Dawson. It suggests that behind our religions is a worship that has arisen in relation to agricultural production. And it's the worship of a common deity, then, that lies at the root of all cultures, all higher cultures, certainly, the enduring ones. Religion and the moral code it provides are also the basis of common social action. For only when a people have a common notion of right and wrong and share a common moral vision can they rise above the might makes right ethos that is the law of the jungle. Only with a common moral vision is there a possibility that they will cooperate on a scale large enough to overcome the challenges of nature out there and also their own internal human nature. Hence the truth of any particular religion aside, let's leave that argument for a moment, Dawson would argue that there is utilitarian value in the fact that a people are religious because then they can cooperate to advance their culture. Second point, Dawson defines what it means for us here in the West that we have Judaism and Christianity at the foundation of our civilization, what we once called, tellingly, Christendom. It means that we have evolved a certain way of thinking that is different from that of the Chinese or the Indians or the ancient Greeks and Romans. It means that we possess a linear conception of time with a beginning and an end along with its corollary, which is the possibility, anyway, of progress, of advancing through time, not just being caught in an endless circle where we're doomed to repeat the past and the mistakes of the past, where we're doomed or fated to. It means that we believe each person has been created in the image of God and thus has an inestimable dignity as well as inalienable rights. It means we seek to establish dominion over nature as well, ideally, as being good stewards over nature. It means we are restless to spread the good news about our life, destiny, and civilization to parts unknown. These are some of the ideas and characteristics that historically have defined us as Westerners, and they ultimately come, Dawson argues, from our religion, our religious faith. As Dawson put it, I'm quoting here, "To live for eternal truths while facing every practical responsibility and meeting the demands of the present moment on their own ground, that is the spirit by which a Christian culture lives and is known. For Christian culture involves a ceaseless effort to widen the frontiers of the kingdom of God, not only horizontally by increasing the number of Christians, but vertically by penetrating deeper into human life and bringing every human activity into closer relation with its spiritual center." Third point. It follows from the two previous points that I've just made that the more a culture drifts from its religious roots, the more likely it is to encounter serious problems and dislocations. In fact, Dawson defined the modern problem, which is also a postmodern problem, largely in terms of secularization, something we just heard quite a bit about. He explained, quoting again, "The secularization of Western Christendom involved, first, the loss of Christian unity, which was itself due not to secularization, but to the violence of religious passion and the conflict of rival doctrines. Secondly, it involved the abdication by Christians of their responsibilities in certain fields of social activity, such as education. So that we may say that 19th century England, to give an example, was still a Christian society, but a Christian society that had diverted its energies to the pursuit of wealth. And finally," I'm still quoting Dawson here, "and finally, it involved a loss of belief, which was to a certain extent inevitable, since the stability of faith had already been undermined by the two processes previously mentioned." Now, to state the problem in a simplified form, if one century destroyed the unity of Christendom by religious divisions, and a second century confined the Christian way of life to a private sphere, the sphere of individual conduct, and then allowed the outer world of society and politics virtually to go its own way without a Christian leavening, then a third century finds that the average man accepts the external social world as the objective standard of reality and regards the inner world of faith and religion as subjective, unreal, and illusory. This, according to Dawson, is the modern problem. Dawson indicted secularization for a host of consequences that followed: the decline of the family, for social pathologies, for totalitarian ideologies that tried to replace the transcendent, for intellectual confusion, and for moral dissipation. Fourth point. Dawson argues that the exit strategy, or way out of the modern problem, involves nothing short of the re-Christianization of Western culture, and not from the top down, but from the bottom up. Salvation will not be found in a state religion. He's not urging the West to return to a theocracy or to an ecclesiocracy. He pointed at the Roman Empire to illustrate. It was not the decrees of Constantine, but the blood of the martyrs that established Christianity as a social and moral force. Again, this is bottom up, not top down. Dawson conceded that the return from a secular civilization to a Christian way of life involves a reversal of many historical forces that transcend not only the limits of our personal experience, but even our particular society. Yet, this is a very important point in Dawson and for historians who wish to understand Dawson. History ultimately is not so much about large impersonal forces, but about the thousands upon thousands of decisions made by the human person exercising free will. It is the individual mind that is the creative force which determines the ultimate fate of cultures. And the first step in the transformation of culture is a change in the pattern of culture within the mind. This explains the importance of education, catechesis, and moral formation to Dawson. It has been on the plane of ideas that the process of the secularization of culture began, and it is only by a change of ideas that this process can be reversed. Here Dawson underscores a theme that certainly would be echoed by Richard Weaver decades later, that ideas do indeed have consequences, which leads to my fifth point. When Dawson writes of the re-Christianization of the West, he has in mind the historic faith, not some therapeutic religion that you'll see on the self-help shelves at Borders or Barnes & Noble, and not something you'll see spewed out on Jenny Jones. We're not talking about a therapeutic religion here. And it's not some syncretic theism such as you'll find in Toynbee and the New Age movement. Dawson is talking about only Orthodox Christianity as it has historically developed. a religion with a specific revelation, jealously guarded dogmas, and transcendentally sanctioned norms of behavior. Only the historic faith could constitute a genuine re-Christianization and recovery of our culture. Now, a moment ago, I mentioned Dawson's emphasis on the individual as the chief agent of historical change, especially in his capacity as a moral being. Now, this leads to the question and to the sixth point, namely, what kind of society, what kind of political economy is most hospitable to individuals' free will and thus to the recovery of the West? Now, in some way, the intelligentsia's love affair with the French Revolution and its flirtation with the Soviet Union. He shared with Voegelin an abhorrence of totalist ideologies that had immanentized the transcendent. It would, however, be a mistake to see Dawson as an apologist of laissez-faire capitalism. He was a champion of freedom, to be sure, but of an ordered freedom. It was a freedom disciplined by religion to order our passions, a freedom disciplined by education, hopefully a liberal arts education, to order our mind, a freedom disciplined by the rule of law to order our polity, and a freedom disciplined by a humane application of the laws of the marketplace to order our economy. Now, all these various ways of ordering our lives make true freedom possible. They have certainly created the climate for freedom to flourish throughout much of American history. Weaken or eliminate any of these spheres of order, and freedom becomes problematic. Seventh point, and also pertinent to our conversations this weekend, Dawson insists that we have humility, that we have the humility to recognize our limitations in divining the future. I was relieved when George said at the beginning of our panel that we were not to put a crystal ball out here and try to divine the future, because Dawson certainly would not have entertained that. You will find no such airy notions in Dawson as the end of history. To the Christian, the hidden principle of the life of culture and the fate of nations and civilizations must always be found in the heart of man and in the hand of God, he writes. There is no limit to the efficacy of faith and to the influence of these acts of spiritual decision, which are ultimately the response of particular men to God's call, especially as revealed in particular historical and personal social circumstances. Here again, Dawson drew from Burke, who wrote that the so-called laws of history, which attempt to subordinate the future to some kind of historical determinism, are but the artificial combinations of the human mind. There always remains an irreducible element of mystery in history. As Burke observed, a child, a girl at the door of an inn, have changed the face of the future and almost of nature. What we do know is that to Christians, the mystery of history is not completely dark, since it is a veil which only partially conceals the creative activity of spiritual forces and the operation of spiritual laws. Individual acts of spiritual decision, writes Dawson, ultimately bear social fruit. The great cultural changes and the historic revolutions that decide the fate of nations or the character of an age are the cumulative result of a number of spiritual decisions, the faith and insight, or the refusal and blindness of individuals. No one can put his finger on the ultimate spiritual act that tilts the balance and makes the external order of society assume a new form. In this sense, we may adapt Burke's saying and assert, this is remarkable, Dawson will assert this, he has the boldness to assert this, and assert that the prayer of some unknown Christian or some unrecognized and unadmitted act of spiritual surrender could change the world. Which segues into my eighth and final point. Now, Pache, some of my colleagues, Dawson would urge us not to abandon hope. Dawson himself was a man of great hope, not optimism, which only goes as deep as the optic nerve in what you can see, but hope, the theological virtue of hope. In his essay, Christian Culture is a Culture of Hope,
Dawson upbraids those Christians who feel a certain satisfaction or a kind of schadenfreude at the hard times on which liberalism has fallen and the loss of hope in the future of modern civilization. He's scolding his colleagues among his Catholic convert friends. He's also scolding the Calvinists and the Jansenists of our day who believe that Christianity is, by definition, a religion of crisis, a judgment that regards even the highest achievements of culture as vitiated by man's fallen nature and doomed to destruction. Dawson countered that Christianity, properly understood, does not delight in the frustration of human achievement or the condemnation of culture. On the contrary, there is no religion, and perhaps no philosophy, which is so deeply concerned with man as part of a community, or which attaches a higher significance to history. For Christianity is essentially the religion of the incarnation, of the divine intervention in history at a particular time and in a particular social context. Thus, while Christianity rejects the nonsense that we could reach some end of history in this life, in this world, it does not deny the possibility of progress in a deeper sense. It teaches that in the course of time, humanity has been leavened and permeated by a transcendent principle, and every culture or human way of life is capable of being influenced and remolded by this divine influence. Thus, Christianity has always been a culturally creative force. And I want to wrap things up with this illustration. Dawson often pointed to the Roman Empire because he saw parallels between the decline of Rome in our own day. Christianity, and I'm quoting here, came first into a world which was over-civilized, where the social soil was becoming exhausted, and the burden of empire and law was becoming too heavy for human nature to bear. And it transformed and renewed this civilization, not by any program of social or political reform, but by revealing the existence of a new spiritual dimension and bringing the light of hope to those who sat in darkness and in the shadow of death. The heartless, hopeless Rome, which found its monstrous expression in the Colosseum and in the gladiatorial games, became the Rome of St. Leo and the Rome of St. Gregory, a city which laid the foundations of a new world, the world of the Christian Middle Ages, while its own pagan world was falling in ruin all about it. The remaking of an old culture by the birth of a new hope constituted the paradox of Christian civilization, according to Dawson. And he commented, in the same way that Russell Kirk was very struck by a particular poem, Dawson also commented on this. He said, it's precisely G.K. Chesterton's insight expressed in his longest poem, The Ballad of the White Horse. Commenting on Chesterton's poem, Dawson wrote, I'm quoting, "It is the paradox that the pagan worship of nature is in the end a religion of death, while the Christian who is indifferent to the temporal results of his actions is the servant and guardian of life." In any case, despite the end of the Cold War, the West remains threatened by many things, both outside, for example, still the existence of weapons of mass destruction, and inside by this debonair nihilism, as Alan Bloom used to call it. Dawson saw striking parallels between our own time and the falling empire of the Romans. Thus, he wrote, we find ourselves back in the same situation as that which the Christians encountered during the decline of the ancient world. He writes, everything depends on whether the Christians of the New Age are equal to their mission, whether they are able to communicate their hope to a world in which man finds himself alone and helpless before the monstrous forces which have been created by man to serve his own ends, but which have now escaped from his control and threatened to destroy him. So to return to the question posed to this panel, why should conservatives worry about the 21st century? Well, I think it's because thinkers like Dawson and Kirk and others who we'll be discussing this weekend told us exactly what the stakes were and were so articulate in their ability to look at the roots of culture and what it takes to keep those roots well nourished. For the West to survive, Dawson would urge a recovery of religion. He would encourage us in our mission to expand the frontiers of the kingdom of God within, in our soul, and without, in society. And he would counsel us not to be seduced by secular ideologies, but to cultivate the virtue of hope. For ultimately, the matter is in God's hands. hands. Thank you.